I'll be joining University of Sussex this fall to start a postdoc with David Seary and Chris Byrne. So I'm going to talk about some recent work that I did in collaboration with Chris, Godfrey Lung, who's a PhD student at Nottingham, and my supervisor, Ed Copeland. So over the last few years, models of multi-field inflation have attracted a lot of attention for a number of different reasons. And one of those reasons is their ability to amplify an initially small bispectrum of curvature fluctuations through continued evolution of zeta, the curvature perturbation, well outside the Hubble radius. Now, to connect the physics of multi-field inflation, or indeed any theory of inflation with observation, statistics of zeta, such as the bispectrum, should ideally be followed beyond the end of inflation through any subsequent physics, such as reheating, and all the way up until the time that the microwave background anisotropy was imprinted, because that's where we're observing these statistics. Now, of course, without a fundamental UV complete theory that describes all the early universe physics, such as reheating, that's impossible, and typically we rely on conservation. So as is well known, in the absence of non-adiabatic fluctuations, the curvature perturbation zeta becomes a conserved quantity on super-Hubble scales. And so when in the limit that any non-adiabatic fluctuations have decayed sufficiently, the statistics of zeta in that limit are those that are relevant for observation today. From that point onwards, we can project its statistics forward. But whether or not that limit is reached before the end of inflation, or perhaps more importantly, before the start of reheating, is a model-dependent question. And so we should really expect reheating to promote further evolution in zeta. And so we can begin to ask some fairly simple questions. How sensitive are the primordial observables, such as the level of non-Gaussianity and the tilt of the power spectrum? How sensitive are these quantities to reheating? Perhaps most importantly, does the level of non-Gaussianity that exists at the start of reheating persists to the completion of reheating, or is it generically damped away as the universe approaches this adiabatic state? So by focusing on some toy models, we're going to try and shed some light on these questions. So I'll begin with an overview of how we compute observables beyond the Hubble radius, and for this purpose we'll make use of the delta N formalism. And we'll then follow these observables through a phase of reheating that we model perturbatively, and then I'll present a summary and an outlook on where I think effort needs to be made in certain directions on this topic. Okay, so thanks to the WMAP satellite, which is soon going to be superseded by Planck, we now have a snapshot of the universe, and it was really relatively young, and these come in the form of these maps of the CMB. And on the one hand, we've learned from these maps that the universe appears very homogeneous and isotropic. But when we look on smaller scales, we observe these small temperature fluctuations. And these are well described, well explained by the theory of inflation. So as we all know, inflation proposes a period of quasi-exponential expansion, which stretches the vacuum fluctuations in one or more light fields beyond the Hubble radius. And over time, these fluctuations are gravitationally amplified, and they later re-enter our Hubble radius to lay the foundation of all the structure that we observe. So in the simplest single-field models, if the field is light enough to vary slowly during a Hubble time, its potential will dominate over its kinetic, acting like a cosmological constant and driving acceleration. And during this time, the co-moving Hubble radius decreases, and this solves some of the problems that are associated with the standard Big Bang scenario. Now, I'm going to take the definition of single field inflation to mean that one direction in field space and one direction only is responsible for the accelerated expansion and for the generation of the curvature perturbations. And with that definition, single field models produce robust and falsifiable predictions. Indeed, they predict a nearly scale invariant spectrum curvature fluctuations which have a nearly Gaussian distribution. In particular, Maldacena's consistency relation that was generalized by Criminelli and Zaldarriaga tell us that the local type nonlinearity parameter, which parameterizes the amount of non-Gaussianity, is slow roll suppressed, and it's likely to be too small to be ever observed, even by Planck. Now, the real utility of Maldacena's result is that it's independent of the underlying inflation reaction, under the assumption that the inflaton was the only sink was under the assumption that there was only one relevant dynamical field. And so if Planck were to measure a large FNL, this would automatically rule out all models of single field inflation, and so up to some caveats, and so we need to look elsewhere for a theory that was consistent with current observations. So I thought, since we're going to be concerned with the super horizon, super Hubble evolution of zeta and its correlation functions throughout this talk, I'd just spend a moment to define exactly what zeta is. So as the name suggests, zeta is defined as the perturbation in spatial curvature on uniform density hypersurfaces. So in cosmology, we generally describe perturbations of our observable universe with respect to some unperturbed background universe whose metric we can write in the following way. And then we perturb around this metric, and this defines zeta. So here gamma ij just accounts for the tensor contribution in an inflationary setting, and we can choose it to have unit determinants such that a volume of a universe described, which is bounded by fixed spatial coordinates, is simply proportional to the locally defined scale factor. And then to compute zeta, we need to choose a gauge. So it's convenient to work in the uniform density gauge. So we can start from some initial flat slice at time t star. And throughout this talk, I'm going to use subscript star to denote the time that a particular fluctuation mode of interest left the Hubble radius during inflation. And then from this time, we can define the amount of expansion up to a uniform density surface at some later time tc in the following way. And from that expression, it's fairly clear that zeta is simply given by the perturbation in the number of e-foldings between an initially flat slice and a slice of constant density. Now, to make use of the formalism, we need to work on scales much larger than the Hubble radius, such that the evolution of a particular patch in the universe, its local evolution, is well approximated by the evolution of some unperturbed universe up to small corrections. And this is the separate universe approximation. And as is well known, the separate universe approximation leads to local energy conservation in the limit that there are no isocurvature perturbations. And so zeta becomes a conserved quantity well outside of the Hubble radius. And that's been verified to all orders of perturbation theory. Okay. So the assumption, if you like, that zeta has a Gaussian distribution is basically a simplifying assumption that allows us to specify all properties of that distribution once we know the two-point correlation function, or equivalently the power spectrum in Fourier space. And any information that's contained in a departure from a perfect Gaussian isn't encoded in that two-point function and has to be extracted from measurements of higher-order correlators, such as the bispectrum. So the bispectrum correlates three wave vectors in momentum space and due in Fourier space, and these wave vectors need to form a triangle due to momentum constraints, as is reflected by the presence of the delta function. And observations typically constrain what we refer to as FNL, the nonlinearity parameter, which just measures the ratio of the bispectrum to the square of the power spectrum. And it's clear from that definition that the FNL is shape and amplitude dependent. So by shape, we mean the shape of triangle. And an important theoretical discovery that was made towards the end of the last decade is that a violation of any one of these three conditions generates a unique non-Gaussian signal, which is peaked in a particular triangular configuration in momentum space. And based on these conditions, there have been a plethora of models proposed in the literature which can generate a large FNL. And most of these models lie in either one of two categories. The first are those models which generate a large FNL due to intrinsic quantum fluctuations of the fields within the Hubble radius. And the second are those which generate a large FNL due to non-trivial classical dynamics on super Hubble scales. Now here we're interested in multiple fields which generate a large FNL outside of the Hubble radius. They fall into that latter category. And in particular, we're going to be interested in multiple field models which generate a large FNL during slow roll, even if the perturbation, even if the fluctuations of the fields at Hubble exits are practically Gaussian. So this rules out for this within this case, the curvaton scenario and the modulated reheating scenario, for example, aren't included in this case, since although they rely on an inflationary seed perturbation, they amplify it through a non-inflationary mechanism. So if we disallow non-canonical kinetic terms, then Maldacena's result is going to guarantee that the models of interest have two or more dynamically relevant fields, and we arrive at the simple form for the inflationary action. So to compute the observables, we can appeal to the separate universe approximation. So we expand about our fields into a background and a perturbation, and then Taylor expand n up to second order about the fields at horizon at a Hubble exit. So here these derivatives need to be evaluated on surfaces of constant h as our choice of gauge demands. And in general, they're time dependent. And that's the mechanism which allows zeta to evolve on super Hubble scales. So we then need to take the correlators of zeta, and if we take the delta phis as uncorrelated stochastic variables at Hubble exits with a massless spectrum of fields in de Sitter space, we can fairly easily take the two-point correlator of zeta or equivalently define its power spectrum, from which we can derive quantities of key interest such as the tilt and the ratio of tensor power to scalar power. And in much the same way, one can derive the three-point correlator. The calculation is more involved, but essentially it consists of two terms. The first is a term which is momentum dependent and comes from quantizing the fields within the Hubble radius. And this is the three-point function of the fields inside the Hubble radius. And David Seary and Jim Lidsey were the first to compute this back in 2005. The second term is momentum independent and comes from the evolution of non-linearities outside the Hubble radius. And we often refer to this as being local in real space because it's independent of scale, and this is where FNL local gets its name. Now this function f, you can show, is bounded between two values which correspond to the geometrical limits of, I think, the squeezed and equilateral momentum triangles. And since r, the scalar to tensor ratio, is much less than 1, is constrained to be much less than 1 by observation, we can neglect the contribution of this term in the limit that the super Hubble dynamics dominates. And this is the regime that we're going to work in this talk.
What is
it's due to non-adiabatic fluctuations, essentially. So for the skeptics, the delta n recently, this delta n approach to computing the inflationary bispectrum has been justified with an underlying quantum field theory by David Seary and two of his students. Okay, so in some ways, the easy part of this calculation has been done. We have expressions for the observables in terms of derivatives of the e-folding number with respect to some initial conditions. But making use of them is actually very difficult in a multi-field context. So to illustrate this, the crucial difference between single-field and multi-field inflation is that in single-field inflation, the slow roll solution forms a one-dimensional phase space. And this means that once the inflationary attractor has been reached, there's a unique trajectory on which all subsequent dynamics will take place. In particular, the end of inflation will occur at a fixed value of the inflaton field, and this will coincide with the surface of constant density. However, and that makes it very trivial to compute the delta n derivatives. However, in multi-field models, there's an infinite number of possible classical trajectories in phase space. For example, the end of inflation will in general occur at different classical values of your inflaton fields, depending on which trajectory was originally originally chosen. And that makes the computation much more complicated in general. So to illustrate this, consider the example where the potential is some separable in the fields. If the slow roll conditions hold, then we can write the number of e-foldings during inflation in this way. And from that, it's fairly clear that the integral over 5, for example, will depend on the Hubble exit value of the other field.
So just a question, how many fields are slowly rolling?
At the moment, this is completely general. There's no assumption on slow roll at all. That's right, this expression will. But as regards the delta n formula for these observables, they're independent of slow roll. There's no slow roll. What I've said is so far, apart from that line, is completely general. No. Everything that I said up until that point is completely general. Now I want to illustrate why the calculation is difficult, why it's difficult to obtain derivatives of n in multi-field models. And it's difficult because this upper limit of this integral needs to be evaluated on a surface of constant density, that upper limit C. And that surface of constant density will be perturbed if I change the initial conditions on my fields. And the same goes for the integral over chi. So essentially what's required is an extra piece of information. You need to write down a conserved quantity that remains invariant when I wiggle my endpoints, my starting point and my endpoint. Now, as far as I'm aware, to date, that's only been done under conditions that the potential is either sum or product separable in the fields and that the slow roll conditions hold. So that really restricts the class of models that are analytically tractable. Of course, there exist other formalisms to compute the superhorizon correlators, such as the moment transport equations or the alternative long wavelength formalism. But there exist analogous quantities in those formalisms that are similar to these delta n derivatives. And analytic progress can only be made under conditions of separability and slow roll. And so that's the statement. Currently, as far as I'm aware, there's no procedure for computing these objects beyond slow roll for arbitrary W. So an alternative then, and because that's of no use to us, we'd like to go beyond slow roll to study how these things evolve during reheating. And so an alternative is to solve the background equations numerically. So we can start by evolving the classical background trajectory whose equation we can derive from the classical action. And then we can perturb around this trajectory. And neighboring trajectories are going to suffer a slightly different expansion history in order to bring them up to an energy density that coincides with this fiducial one. And we can form what we refer to as a bundle of trajectories by evolving many such neighboring trajectories. And this enables us to build a matrix of expansion histories on that surface of constant density. And from that matrix, it's fairly trivial to take the derivative of n with respect to the initial field conditions. Now, I shouldn't have said fairly trivial, because it's actually not a trivial thing to do numerically. If you want to deal with rapidly oscillating fields, which you do in reheating, that typically requires long integration times. And also, this function, n as a function of phi star, can be very flat, and so you need to deal with truncation and round-off error. But it can be done, and we've tested the code that we've developed against the only known exact solution that goes beyond slow roll. So it's fairly. This has a nice geometrical interpretation. This bundle description. The evolution of zeta outside of the Hubble radius is essentially a consequence of focusing or defocusing this bundle. In the adiabatic limit, this bundle would degenerate to a caustic, and all the trajectories would lie along a single line. And it's in this limit that zeta, the statistics of zeta, are those that we would be observing today. If the this adiabatic limit has been reached before reheating starts. So the question is, when can I stop calculating? And there are at least two ways in which the perturbations produced by multi-field inflation can become adiabatic. The first is to pass through a sufficiently long phase of single-field inflation. And Joel Myers and Navin Sivanandam showed that if this is the case during inflation, then any large non-Gaussianity that's generated is typically damped away to zero as you achieve this adiabatic limit, except in very special cases where you need to fine-tune your initial conditions. The second case is to pass through a sufficiently long phase of thermal equilibrium with no non-zero conserved quantum numbers. And Weinberg demonstrated that that solution is an adiabatic attractive solution. And Joel Myers, just before Christmas, verified that in thermal equilibrium, the correlators of zeta also remain conserved outside the Hubble radius, which is an important result because it's the correlators of zeta that we observe rather than zeta itself. So unlike this converging to a single field case, we find that FNL typically can remain large if it's large before reheating begins. So what does it matter? Or what does it mean? Okay, so in our case, I simply mean that the universe is going to be completely radiation dominated. It's going to be dominated by a relativistic species because that's an adiabatic solution. There should be no...
Sure, but it's not during the multi-field domination.
No.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. So the question is, how does that affect the... And perhaps it's also worth pointing out that there's currently no evidence for non-adiabatic fluctuations in the CMB, which offers more motivation as to why we should follow these perturbations until they become adiabatic before the CMB is imprinted. So this brings us on to reheating. So by the time inflation has ended, the universe is typically in a highly non-thermal state. And so a consistent theory of inflation has got to explain how the universe was reheated. And depending on how inflation ends and how the inflaton sector transfers its energy to the standard model degrees of freedom, reheating can proceed very differently. A number of previous studies have uncovered a wide array of both perturbative and non-perturbative effects. It's not possible in one slide to do justice to all the people that have contributed to this topic. So for the purposes of trying to study for the first time, I think, how reheating affects the evolution of zeta, we're going to parameterize reheating in a phenomenological way by assuming that it proceeds perturbatively. So we're going to ignore a lot of this non-perturbative effects, such as parametric resonance and back reaction, just to make things a little simpler for a first-time investigation. So in the simple perturbative scenario, as inflation ends, the inflaton approaches its minimum and begins to oscillate rapidly on a time scale short compared to the Hubble time. And if the minimum is quadratic, this inflaton condensate redshifts away like pressureless dust if we can approximate the minimum as quadratic. And in the perturbative scheme, the amplitude of these oscillations decay due to the Hubble expansion and due to the transfer of energy to lighter particles that are produced by this oscillating field. And as these decay products thermalize, the universe is reheated. So to model the decay of the inflaton, we can proceed phenomenologically by reheating into a scalar field psi through prototype three-leg and four-leg interaction terms. And without going into all the details, because they're not all relevant to us here, one can quantize that reheat field by decomposing it into annihilation and creation operators, and then solve for the mode functions of the equation of motion for the psi field through the formalism of time-dependent Bogoliubov transformations. And then through the Bogoliubov coefficients, one can extract the time-dependent frequency of the k-modes and their occupation numbers. And those are the ingredients that are needed in a Boltzmann calculation to determine the co-moving energy density that's stored in that reheat field. Now, what's in a paper by Jonathan Braden, Lev Kaufman, and Neil Barnaby, they showed that if the four-leg decay channel dominates the decay phi phi to psi psi, then typically reheating never completes. The problem is that volume dilution happens faster than the decay channel phi phi to psi psi can drain energy from the condensate, and so typically the universe is left as a very cool and non-thermally dominated place. And so we're going to work in the limit that the three-leg interaction term is dominant, in which case the co-moving density in the psi field drops off like this. Simple energy conservation arguments then show that a similar equation enable you to write down a similar equation for the inflaton field, which shows that the co-moving energy density just drops off exponentially. So the last term in the action there, lambda over 4 to phi, psi to the 4, bounds the potential for psi from below. And so long as that psi field is sufficiently close to its minimum during inflation, it shouldn't play any role during inflation. That's an assumption, I think, that goes into the model. So you'll notice that this equation looks very much like that of a perfect fluid, which is, a radiation, looks like a perfect radiation fluid, which is sourced by this gamma term. So we can choose to model the decay products as a relativistic fluid that's sourced by this oscillating inflaton, where we've used here that if the inflaton really is oscillating on a time scale short compared to the Hubble time, then we can replace its energy density by the average of its kinetic energy over a single oscillation cycle. And we can use similar arguments to write down a description of the decay of the inflaton. So this is referred to as the elementary theory of reheating.
If you imagine that the things are slow rolling through field space and moving on gradient, I guess the gradient of that function will not be in the pure phi direction. Is that cubic term there?
I think that's correct.
And I guess if it's still pretty close to the phi direction, then just having it roll on the phi direction is a good approximation. So that's maybe a question for what we're coming.
So I think in general, I mean, you need to choose that. So that's, I think, the answer to that question. The parameterized scheme that we're going to consider here, we're going to treat gamma as a free parameter in a sense. And we take that view to try and work out how the observables are dependent on varying gamma. So you can compute gamma if you know your coupling constants. But for our purposes, it's a free parameter. So we're also going to assume that because we have two fields, we're going to apply this perturbative scheme to both fields where the when this regime is applicable, which is only when this field is rapidly oscillating about its minimum. So this decay term, gamma phi dot, shouldn't be present during inflation. And we also require this condition to be satisfied in order for the Bogoliubov transformation, in order for the calculation to be valid. So in the simple perturbative scheme, reheating completes when the Hubble rate drops below the decay rate, and in order for in order not to spoil the success of BBN, the universe should be totally radiation dominated before the BBN epoch, and this constrains the reheat temperature and places a lower bound on the total decay rate, which again we assume is always satisfied.
This is a very standard assumption that the decay kind of turns on after inflation, but how do you envision that being actually realized? What prevents the silicon from decaying during inflation?
Nothing as such. Then you have a regime like warm inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, in quantum field theory, we normally associate particle production with rapid oscillations of fields.
So do you see this as an effective field theory?
Yeah, I mean, we're working within the regime of an effective field theory.
I guess also usually the situation is that gamma becomes comparable to the Hubble rate at the reheating at the time of reheating.
When the Hubble rate is smaller than the
Hubble rate is much smaller than the Hubble rate.
Yeah.
Is that sufficient? If you just dial down that gamma is much, much less than H during inflation, is that effective? Is that enough to prevent it from?
I guess what you're saying there is that your coupling constants are small during inflation.
But I mean, I don't want to change my coupling constants. I want the same theory to apply during inflation and after inflation. So if I just set my coupling constant so that H equals gamma happens long after inflation, not during inflation, mm-hmm. Is that sufficient to make sure I don't end up with warm inflation, that I don't have any significant?
I would say no.
Okay.
There's a lot of debate over whether this is actually. There's a very fine regime in which this perturbative scheme is applicable. The inflaton really does have to be rapidly oscillating. You'll notice from that Klein-Gordon equation that there's actually no transfer of energy from that field to the decay products. All that gamma phi dot term is doing is damping the oscillations, which should be a good approximation so long as the field really is very rapidly oscillating. But I think that's the only regime in which it can be used. So perhaps it's also, I said that the Hubble, that we switch on reheating when the Hubble rate drops below the decay rate. I shouldn't have said that. We switch on reheating when, so we introduce these decay terms into the field equations, so gamma is switched on, if you like, when the fields pass through its minimum for the very first time. So what's left to do then is to try and study some models that have some fairly generic properties. So in order to amplify an initially small bispectrum, we need a region of the potential where the trajectories can diverge or converge. And that can be generated by a region of the potential that has a ridge or a region of the potential that has a valley. So in this case, the potential has a ridge in the phi direction, from which the bundle of trajectories is going to fall off, and it doesn't possess a focusing region where the neighboring trajectories can reconverge due to its runaway nature in the phi direction. So the phi direction doesn't have a minimum, and we don't reheat from it. We only reheat from the chi field, which is going to drive inflation. So in order to source that large non-Gaussianity, what's required is that the initial trajectory needs to be very finely tuned to be almost parallel to the axis of inflation. And what that means is that the phi field needs to start almost right on the top of its ridge at phi equals zero, and that the gradient of that ridge needs to be very shallow, which is set by lambda. And this means that this phi field remains in slow roll throughout all of inflation, and even after inflation ends, when we begin to reheat from the inflaton. So this is what FNL looks like. This is what the evolution of FNL looks like during reheating. So the x-axis is labeling the number of e-folds of inflation since the relevant mode left the Hubble radius. This vertical black line is the end of inflation, and the vertical blue dashed line is the start of reheating. and we terminate the simulation when we're totally radiation dominated, which is when the statistics of zeta are going to stop evolving. So these rapid oscillations that you're seeing in FNL are induced because of the inflaton field oscillating about its minimum. The amplitude of the spikes are essentially set by the point where the inflaton field is at the maximum of its oscillation. And these eventually decay because the oscillation in the field decays. Now, it's perhaps worth pointing out that in scenarios such as the curvetron scenario, where instant reheating is assumed, if you'd have instantly reheated off of the peak of this spike, you would have calculated a very different FNL to what we're calculating, where the decay is gradual, where we don't assume instant reheating. So what we're seeing is that as the decay rate is, for weaker decay rates, the final value of FNL becomes suppressed. And we can explain this by appealing to two limiting cases. The first is, if reheating did happen instantaneously, when the inflaton crosses its minimum, we'd expect FNL to freeze in almost immediately. The other case to consider is when the decay rate is equal to zero, so there's no reheating. In this case, what we find is that FNL slowly creeps towards zero. And this continued evolution is simply because the bundle of trajectories is continuing to diverge along the valley floor of the potential. But to explain why that drives FNL to zero, we need to look at the individual derivative terms which contribute to FNL. So it helps to measure time along this trajectory by the advance of the Hubble rate, which is a monotonic function, and that remains true during reheating.
Sorry, just to understand a little bit, the fact that as time progresses, FNL converges or stabilizes, does that give you a scale-dependent FNL? An observable scale-dependent? Is that what you're
saying? No.
So what are the observable?
So what observers would measure, so long as there's no more evolution after this point, is the value of FNL
here. It's that one. Okay.
Yeah. So what we'd like to explain is why, when you have a weaker decay rate, is FNL being suppressed. So the logical case is to consider, firstly, when there's no reheating.
In your expression, do you have a relationship for the amount of that final FNL as a power, say, of gamma, or is there a simple dependence on
that? So, in general, I'm working on that now. In general, no, I haven't found one. Simply because your final value of FNL is sensitive to the entire evolution of your trajectory, because you're wanting dependence on your initial conditions. So in general, unless you can solve your background equations beyond slow roll, I can't give you an analytic at the moment.
Since you did it numerically, I mean, if you just plotted the answer as a function of gamma, you don't get straight lines and a lot of plot, right?
No, so yeah, we're looking like we have a turnover. So what we're interested in now is seeing if we can bound FNL regardless of your decay rates. But that's work in progress.
And the units for gamma in your plot were Hubble?
Yeah, so they're in units of... They're in units of the potential normalization. They're in units of the decay rate. They're in units of the Hubble rate at reheating. So if you measure time along the trajectory by the energy density, and we expand about the ridge to first order, and this should be okay so long as the phi field only explores a region of the potential which is well approximated by that expansion, we find that this phi field grows with the grows exponentially with the square of the Hubble rate. So remember that h decreases during inflation, so phi will grow. And then, because the slow roll conditions hold for this phi field, we can get an analytic approximation for how this derivative n phi evolves. And this derivative will grow increasingly more negative so long as phi grows at least a little more quickly than h squared decays. And that is the regime in which we're working. Now, the sign of this term, which is important, can be inferred from the geometry of the potential. So diverging trajectories will require less expansion in order to bring them to a common hypersurface, and that will result in negative delta n. And that negative sign propagates through into the expression for FNL, and this is how that negative FNL is generated. If the trajectories were to converge, the converse would be true. We'd have a positive FNL. So it's then fairly simple to differentiate this derivative to obtain the second and the cross derivatives. And plugging those back into the original expression allows this to reduce FNL slightly. And then we can differentiate with respect to the inflaton direction, which is going to generate two terms. One is a term evaluated at Hubble exit, and the second is an integral over the entire expansion history. Now, in order to generate this large non-Gaussianity in the first place, we fine-tuned our trajectory, and which meant that we have one of the directions of the potential, the inflaton direction, has a much steeper gradient than the phi direction. And what this means then is that at Hubble exit, surfaces of constant h dot are practically going to coincide with surfaces of constant h when I perturb chi star, and that's because I can neglect the kinetic contribution from the phi field. And so when I take this derivative to a good approximation, it's going to be negligible as long as this condition holds. And it means that n chi just takes on its Hubble exit values, which are slow roll suppressed. And this means we can kill off the last two terms in the top line. And then from simple power counting arguments, as this derivative gets increasingly more negative, FNL will be driven towards zero. And so these two limiting cases explain this behavior. As the K rate is reduced from infinity, reheating takes a longer time to complete. And this allows the bundle of trajectories to spread out further along the valley floor, constantly sourcing a more negative n phi, which drives FNL towards zero.
Yeah. If I just had a single field, just a single field inflation, FNL would not evolve during the heating.
That's correct.
It's only because theta is conserved if it's purely ionic. Where everything you're seeing is the fact that you've got an isocurvature mode.
That's correct.
That's sourcing some FNL, but that isocurvature mode can evolve outside the horizon.
Yes.
And so that's what's triggering the decay.
Yeah.
So if I'm just trying to understand, is this applicable to something like the Kurbatov scenario, where you generally get large FNL even if the Kurbatov never dominates?
So I'm just about to show you a model which is very similar, which we think encompasses the Kurbatov scenario. Okay. So that's
could I
next
one. Yeah. Just go a couple of slides back just to check the terms that were dropped on the FNL expression. One more.
I don't know if you can see the one more.
Yeah, I can see from here. So if you, can you repeat the argument? It's because one of the fields.
The first approximation that's made is, we use this.
Yeah, so one of the curvature is much larger than the other one.
So if this, so these, the n chi derivatives and the n chi chi derivatives are order one.
Yeah.
Whereas the n phi derivative is generally large. The n phi derivative is generally large because this constant beta. So we kill off the last two terms.
So if you had more than one direction slowly rolling, so you have three fields, one is a value learning back to, could you still make that
that's a good point. So if you had three fields, then there'd be many more derivatives that would come in the original expression, and then it's not clear as to how those terms would compete.
Okay.
So I'm not sure.
And the same probably if you had two fields which are valley and one slow.
Yeah, so that's very much like the next model. That
I've lost track of what beta was. Why was beta large?
I should have written down the expression. Beta is a constant which goes something like 1 over phi star lambda. And phi star is, in this case, very small, 10 to the minus 3. That's our initial condition. And lambda is the gradient of the potential, which is very small. So beta ends up being of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6.
Since you've been stuck, if you design the potential so that in the middle of one of those oscillations, the second field mass kind of became larger than the Hubble scale, at that point could you, I don't know if you can involve those things, but at that point would you find that the non-Gaussian is freezing in again? So if you're making it turn into a single field model at that point, would it then, from then on?
So, in general, I think you'd expect to damp out FNL to zero. So what to preserve a large FNL? So let's go back to the original expression for FNL. To preserve a large non-Gaussianity, these derivatives need to be large, or at least, and the second derivatives need to be large. And to do that, you need some sort of turn in your field space. And if you've recovered a single field limit, then those derivatives are going to damp out to zero. And that's essentially the result of Myers and Sivanandan, that if the single field attractor is reached during inflation, you'll generically damp away the bispectrum because you're no longer turning in field space.
So my intuition shouldn't be that it's frozen in the single field limit, it's just that it's always smaller in the single field limit.
Mm. Yeah, unless, so the alternative regime, so you can write during inflation there are analytic, under conditions of separability and slow roll, there's an exact solution for FNL. And essentially, FNL consists of two terms. One is a term that's evaluated at Hubble exit, and the second depends on the entire expansion history. The term that depends on the entire expansion history is only large if you have a turn in field space. So if FNL is large, when you don't have a turn, you need to fine-tune your initial conditions such that the horizon exit term is large. And the statement is that in general, you need to be finely tuned to begin with to generate a large FNL in these multi-field models if you want to have an observer left for now. Yeah. So a similar, reducing this, the expression for the spectral index gives you a similar relation. And from here, because the numerator and the denominator scale in the same way, the spectral index is practically insensitive to the decay rate over many orders of magnitude. And so we can, for this particular model, we can think of it as a more robust inflationary statistic and perhaps a better probe of the underlying inflationary potential because it's insensitive to reheating, unlike FNL, which changes by, in some cases, 10 units. So the second case is very much like the curvaton scenario. So this effective potential is motivated by the axion enflation model of Demopoulos. So in enflation, one uses many string axions to cooperatively source inflation, even though their individual potentials may be too steep. So to arrive at this effective potential, we can assume that one of these axions starts very close to its hilltop, and that the remaining axions begin away from the hilltop. And then by expanding about the minimum of these remaining axions, we can replace them as a collective field, chi, and this is the field that will drive inflation. Now, in this case, we can reheat from both fields because both fields have a minimum. And again, in order to generate a large FNL during inflation, we need to tune our background trajectory. And this amounts again to saying that the axion remains at the top of its ridge and that it's frozen. It remains frozen throughout most of inflation, and it only begins to roll when its mass overcomes Hubble friction. And in this sense, it's very much like the curvaton scenario. And it's also worth mentioning that Jonathan Braden and Lev Kaufman and Neil showed that in models of enflation, reheating typically proceeds preferentially via a perturbative route because parametric resonance effects are suppressed by what they referred to as dephasing of the field oscillations. And that motivates, in some sense, our study of a perturbative reheating scheme. So these are the results. In the left panel, the decay rates are equal. And we find that regardless of their magnitude, the final value of FNL remains completely unchanged. And that's in complete contrast to when there's a mild hierarchy in the decay rates, where FNL can be either enhanced or suppressed relative to the no reheating case. Now, if I'm honest, I can't give you a concrete explanation as to why we're seeing these effects, but I'm currently working with John Myers and a little with Takeshi Kobayashi to use curvaton-like arguments to explain why we're seeing this enhancement or suppression depending on how the decay products of these two fields scale away. And I think these effects are important to understand because these differences are already within the sensitivity of the Planck experiment, for example. And this may be a novel mechanism for generating a large FNL. Again, a similar table as the single minimum case, we find that the spectral index is roughly constant. Final value of FNL can change by many units. And perhaps it's also worth pointing out the two lines above the table that a calculation at the end of inflation would have given the impression of purely Gaussian statistics. And this is just an example of why it's important to keep following the evolution of the curvature perturbation until all the relevant fields have dropped out of the spectrum, or you've reached this adiabatic limit. Yes.
So, for the pure curvature scenario, FNL is traditionally determined by how much energy every time a curvature is in the curvature field.
Yeah.
So that would make sense that your final FNL is depending on the relation between the two decay rates, because that's effectively how long the infliton decays before the curvature decays determines that.
I think so. So what's
that
in
ratio? So does it track the same way? I mean, are you seeing higher? I would guess you would see higher FNL the more similar the two decay rates are. Is that
No, so I mean, regardless of their magnitude, if the decay rates are the same, FNL remains completely insensitive.
Right, because if the decay rates are the same, then it's not really a curviton scenario.
No.
But when the decay rates are different...
It's hard to read the labels there.
It's the blue curve.
Can you tell us
so in the blue curve, the axion has a greater decay rate than the inflaton. And the inflaton minimizes first, and the axion minimizes second. So in this sense, it's similar to a curviton-like scenario. However, in the curviton scenario, you reheat from the axion, the curviton, in a thermal bath of radiation already, whereas here it's different. I mean, and in the curviton scenario, you assume an instant decay, whereas here we're allowing a gradual transfer of energy to the decay product. Which is having subtle differences.
Are these the difference in the decay rates that you look at, are they sufficient so that one the later decaying field is paying the pure radiation back, or are they still close enough that it's actually seeing more of
they're close enough that we're seeing a mixture. So the curviton, in this example, the curviton will come to dominate very briefly, and then it will drop out. So the curviton scenario can be recovered within this model, and that's what we're trying to look at. We're trying to use curviton-like arguments to explain this.
I can't quite read that. Is it 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 4 and then switched?
That's right, yeah. And these differences can become huge. If you have an order of magnitude of 10 to the 7 between these decay rates, which maybe you can start worrying about fine-tuning, you can generate FNL of order 70. I'll come back to that. Sorry.
No,
this one?
Why is R so small?
R is, so everything, that calculation, R is so small.
So this is the axiom scenario, right? Does it still come proportional to field displacement?
Yes.
So one day, so the field displacement is very small, combined with collective.
I think so. I mean, it changes so radically from the end of inflation to here because the derivatives evolve substantially. Quite why it's so small, I'm not sure I can give you a physical explanation.
Which field is dominating the transmission of the power spectrum? Is the power spectrum a mix of both pi and pi?
In these situations, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, everything. Yeah, I mean that. So that result at the top is a calculation that they're just horizon crossing values, and the axion has only started to evolve really after inflation has ended, which is why the differences are so radically different compared to.
That makes sense. Why error is so small? Like basically, adding scalar correlations after inflation, so you're diluting.
Yeah.
Relative
contribution. So it's just because H is evolving. And the values of the field, which normalize the scale of power spectrum.
I think that's another way of saying it. So that's it, really. The key points that I wanted to get across are that the amplitude of FNL, I think, has a limited power to discriminate between multi-field models of inflation. It seems hard that we're going to be able to infer the properties of the underlying inflationary potential from exact values of FNL. However, what's perhaps more important is the sign of FNL, which so far in the models that we've studied seems to remain the same from the end of reheat, from the beginning of reheating to the end of reheating. Furthermore, if FNL is large at the end of inflation, it typically remains large at the end of reheating. And we have the nice result that the spectral index is less sensitive. And whilst discussing all of this sensitivity, I think it is worth keeping in mind the degree of fine-tuning that's required to generate a large FNL in the first place. If you were to shift the decay rate of one of these fields by two orders of magnitude, you'd eradicate any... So if you were to shift the decay rate, if you were to shift, let's say, the initial condition of one of these fields by two orders of magnitude, you'd probably eradicate any non-Gaussianity and probably... that would throw you off an inflationary trajectory. However, changing a decay rate by two orders of magnitude only seems to change FNL by order 10 units. And then some sort of outlook points. It would be nice to study a more robust set of models. It would be interesting to see if reheating can affect other shapes of bispectrum, such as folded or equilateral. There's no reason to stop at the bispectrum. We can consider the trispectrum. And this then opens up the possibility of probing the reheating mechanism through consistency relations, such as the Tsuyama-Yamaguchi inequality, or even the scale dependence of FNL. And then perhaps it might be possible to construct observables or combinations of observables that remain insensitive to reheating. And lastly, it would be nice to study the sensitivity of super-Hubble evolution to non-perturbative effects. And I'll finish there. Thank you.
So one of the things my take-home things I got was that if somewhere between inflation ending and when we see the CMB, if we enter a single-field regime, then we lose all our non-Gaussianities. So that means that if we do see non-Gaussianity, some isocurvature field had to survive right down to the very end of
yes.
The
or you have to be very finely tuned.
So that's a very strong thing. That's a,
sorry?
I recently made a bet that we're going to see non-Gaussianity. I'm starting to worry about my bet.
Okay.
Because you're making it sound like it's a very, very strong constraint to have something So even if you produce it, keeping it is a very difficult thing.
Yes, it is. It's actually telling you, so it's interesting. So to generate a large FNL, if you do achieve this, to preserve a large FNL, you need this hierarchy in initial conditions, which is telling you something about the mass scales of the problem. You need one field much, much more massive than the other one, which is really a probe of the physics that's really going on.
But is the time, supposing that the scalar stays light until the point where you thermalize everything, and then from then on it's thermal, at that point is FNL locked in?
So this is something I'm discussing with Dodi and Joel Myers and Takeshi. I don't have any intuition for that.
I mean, somehow, I guess what bothers me is that there was this picture in a single field case where things were conserved, and so I didn't really need to know anything about what was going on in the middle because of where they were conserved. So you generate whatever you want at the beginning, and then it just stays until the end. I don't see why I don't transition to that at some point if I lose my extra scalar in the middle of the, between inflation and that.
So you can.
That makes it sound like it should be possible to lock in a large FNL at some point midway between inflation and now.
No, I mean, so the result is surprising. You will generally lose your FNL because to recover that, when that lighter field drops out of the spectrum, your inflationary trajectory has converged to a single field case. And that single field case is a straight line. And so those derivatives, the n, d, phi, die off.
Why doesn't that tell you the answer in the thermal case then? Because the thermal and the single field cases were similar in that they were basically tied to one kind of a fluctuation, and you erased anything that's not a beta. So if you're so sure of the answer in the single field case, why doesn't that tell you what it is in the thermal case? Or why are you in doubt about the thermal case?
I'm not sure of the question. Sorry.
Well, so it sounds like when I asked you, could I freeze in the large FNL by going to thermal equilibrium halfway between inflation and now? You sounded like it was a possibility.
Yeah, it's a possibility. If that lighter field then came to dominate at some later time, if it carried some isocurvature perturbation that after the radiation dominated it, then I think that would. Then maybe you could lock in FNL, and maybe it would change after the isocurvature modes of that lighter field become important.
There, you're requiring this field to be around after equilibrium has been done.
Yes.
The fluctuations into the thermal bath at some late time.
I think so.
But you're saying the thermal bath itself will never maintain that large FNL.
Well, so having a thermal bath is an adiabatic solution.
Yeah.
So at that point, FNL will stop evolving.
Yeah, but that was what threw me off. Is that if my intuition is that I can make it stop evolving, then if I have it be large when I go thermal, why doesn't it freeze at some large value?
Well, it would, and that's what we're showing. But it's the approach to that complete thermalization that's important.
So if I quench and I thermalize really quickly, then I don't have time to lose things.
Yeah, then I think you'd expect FNL to freeze in instantly.
Once you tack on to a period of single field, effectively single field expansion, zeta outside the horizon is fixed, so that fixed point moving scale, it won't bend. But if you ask, what is the effect on the actual CMB quadrants, on CMB scales, well, if there's too much of a period of, no matter how much now Gaussian is produced early on, there's too much subsequent effective
what you said.
So if you look at the fixed physical scale today, another way to say that is that the more single field inflation you put between the end of inflation, the more defaults in single field inflation you put between the end of inflation, and the point which are not Gaussian is produced, smaller and smaller than not Gaussian people end up being on the fixed observable physical scale. You know what I mean? Because that's just another way of saying inflated the single field period.
So So you're saying that, the size effect depends on how late.
I think so. I think I'd agree with that.
Just make sure I parsed it. Now you're saying that after inflation ends, how big the effect is on physical scale should depend on how late after inflation it happened. Is that right? The expansion that's determining the difference between co-moving and physical is the expansion between wet to wet box. Is it from the end of inflation until the thermalization, say, or is it?
I'm just saying if there's more than 60, let's take a simple case. If there's more than 60 equals of single field inflation,
okay,
at the end of inflation, then any non-Gaussian that was produced more than 60 equals before the end of inflation will be outside the horizon. So you would effectively,
right,
describe that as saying, look at that fixed co-moving scale, you would effectively describe that as saying that on the CMB scales, the non-Gaussian was greater than zero.
So we're just saying that really, yeah. I mean, FNL just has strong scale dependence in that case. Right?
Yeah. And then, but if there were only 50 e-folds of effective single field inflation, and it was strongly multi-field for the first 10 e-folds, then
you would still see.
Then you'd still see a large, yes,
yeah,
yeah, geometry of those scales.
But you're saying that dynamics accounts as right at horizon exit. The 10 e-volts you're talking about is happening after,
I think,
right?
there is a difference between what we're talking about and the type of isocurvature evolution you have here, because these are local non-Gaussian, so they're kind of by construction they don't have a scale dependence. So I guess they could, but I mean, there is no scale dependence in what you're calculating, is there?
No.
I mean, because
that's what's confusing is that you're talking like the things that are generated in that horizon exit. All the e-folds that you're talking about are during inflation or after inflation?
I am talking about the e-folds. Well, yeah, I'm talking about the e-folds before the radiating down in the mirror. So those are sort of the.
I don't think that's the same decay we're seeing here at all. The decay we're seeing here is during reheating. You're talking about pushing beyond the horizon. I think that's very.
How can it be? I mean, once you get to single field land, if data is preserved as a horizon, how can it be that it's decaying on a fixed moving scale?
It's not.
It would be constant. So I think your original question was if I can achieve a thermal bath instantly, then I should expect my FNL to freeze in instantly. Is that how I interpret your original?
Yeah, I guess my question was that I seem to get two conflicting pieces of intuition. One is that if I can get to a single field limit, I will freeze things in. But the other intuition was that if the approach to the single field limit is, I'm going to actually lose some of my FNL.
Yeah.
And so it makes it sound like I can arrange things so that I can minimize the losses and then freeze in a large value if I design things right.
Yes, and I think that amounts to fine-tuning.
Well, supposing I don't care about fine-tuning, but I just want to know what would I have to fine-tune?
you have to fine-tune your initial conditions and the shape of the potential.
But is it the speed with which things thermalize that is the important thing, or what's the way you're describing it? It sounds like if I take too long getting to equilibrium, that's when I'm going to lose the FNL that I had. So if I do it quickly, I might not have time to.
No. So if we forget about reheating and thermalization and everything, if a single field attractor is reached during multi-field inflation, during slow roll.
I don't want to get rid of thermalization, because the whole thing we're talking about is the thermal thing. I can ask you at lunch, too. It sounds like
okay.
Not a
short answer. Maybe we should discuss it further.
Should we stop there and go to lunch? And thank you again.